From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A new report blames the U.S. government for creating and arming the group alternately known as ISIL, ISIS, and the Islamic State. Press TV's Sheena Sharani has more.
The ISIL terrorists have seized parts of Syria and Iraq and have carried out numerous atrocities against government forces and civilians there. The terrorist group was formed in Syria in 2013. It enjoyed Western support and backing from some regional countries, including Turkey and Qatar, as the group was first focused on fighting the Syrian government in Damascus. The ISIL carried out mass execution of soldiers and civilians and posted gruesome videos of its atrocities online as a terror tactic. It eventually grew in size and power and expanded its terror campaign to Iraq amid silence by the West. The ISIL then seized large swathes of northern Iraq amid international inaction. But over the past months, the situation apparently got out of hand even for the US. Advances by the militants toward Iraq's Kurdistan region, where US personnel are stationed, forced Washington to launch airstrikes against militant positions. And the West seems to be bracing for more trouble. On Tuesday, the ISIL militants released a grisly footage showing the beheading of U.S. journalist James Foley. The American journalist was captured in Syria back in 2012. Foley is seen asking his family to stop the U.S. intervention in Iraq. The ISIL said the beheading was in response to the recent U.S. airstrikes on the Takfiri group in northern Iraq. The decapitation drew widespread condemnation.
Today, the entire world is appalled by the brutal murder of Jim Foley by the terrorist group ISIL. From governments and peoples across the Middle East, there has to be a common effort to extract this cancer so that it does not spread.
The U.S. and its allies had been warned by many experts in some regional countries against supporting insurgents in the region, but the warnings fell on deaf ears.
For the past 3 years, since the events in Syria, people have been talking and begging almost Western nations not to encourage, not to fund, not to support these rebel groups in any way, shape or form, because we know that they morph and they swell into these monstrous groups that actually carry out the most heinous crimes against civilians, essentially.
The campaign against ISIL has been growing stronger over the past weeks. On Wednesday, the German foreign minister said Berlin is ready to send weapons to support Iraqi Kurds in their battle against the ISIL Takfiri militants. Also, Iranian deputy foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian confirmed that Tehran has provided Iraq with advice against the militants. And France says it plans to bring together Iran, Arab governments, and the permanent members of the UN Security Council to coordinate a comprehensive response to the ISIL Takfiri militants. As the world rushes to contain the militants, many observers say the current crisis would not have been caused if the US and its allies had not supported extremist forces in the region.
The murkiness of US involvement with the group is thickening as the disclosure came out that the alleged killer of American journalist James Foley was a British national who heads a group of British nationals fighting the same Syrian government that the U.S.-backed so-called moderate opposition are fighting. This was the U.S. Deputy Spokesperson Marie Harf at her daily press conference Thursday.
Well, according to The Guardian, the person who killed James Foley is a British jihadist, and he's the leader of a British group. A group of fighters in Syria. Is the information correct? Have you confirmed his identity?
Well, we're working on that right now, working very closely with the United Kingdom. Prime Minister Cameron came out yesterday and said it's looking increasingly likely that it was a British citizen. So we are working with them on that. We are concerned about the fact that a number of Westerners, including a small number of Americans, have joined this fight. So that is something we're working very, very closely with them on right now.
Do you know, according to The Guardian, the the Britain's security services said there are increasing numbers of homegrown terrorists leaving the country to fight in Syria and Iraq. Mm-hmm. So you said you have this kind of concern. Mm-hmm. You will have a similar trend in the U.S., right?
I think it's a much smaller number, but we are concerned about foreign fighters going there. It will be a key topic of conversation at the General Assembly.
Are you going to take any actions to deal with this situation?
We've been taking a number of actions, I think, to deal with the situation. Look, we have tried to work with countries in the region to crack down on the flow of foreign fighters from anywhere. I think there are fighters from over 50 countries now that we assess have joined the fight on the side of ISIL. We're very focused on dealing with this and working with other countries in the region to really crack down on the places and ways they can get in. But once they're in Syria, you know, the Syria to Iraq pipeline, unfortunately, has become quite porous, and there's been a lot of fighters going back and forth over that border.
The siege of the East Ukraine city of Donetsk by the military of the U.S.-backed government in Kiev continues to take civilian casualties, along with an ongoing degradation of the humanitarian situation. Press TV's Serena Shim filed this report.
Officials say fighting in Donetsk has left 34 civilians dead and several others injured on Tuesday alone. Civilians in the region are also facing a dire humanitarian crisis, including a lack of essential supplies like food and water. This comes after a months-long battle between the Ukrainian army and pro-Russian fighters fighting for their independence. Press TV went to a Ukrainian army base in the city of Kramatorsk, just outside Donetsk, to get the military's perspective on events.
The Ukrainian army is cleaning out the areas of Ilovais and Zukres. These are important areas because we need to break rebel connection from Donetsk to Horlovka.
In the meantime, the Ukrainian government and pro-Russian fighters are both claiming control of the small town of Ilovaisk in the Donetsk region after fierce fighting has been taking place in the area.
The rebels are bombing our positions near the villages and in return are bombing them back. Now our main goal is to try and close the border with Russia.
Although the Ukrainian military's so-called anti-terror operation is in full swing, presidents of Ukraine and Russia will meet in Minsk for a political negotiation to stop the war, which according to the United Nations has so far claimed over 2,000 lives. Serena Shim, Press TV, Kramatorsk, Eastern Ukraine.
There was an emergency closed session meeting of the UN Security Council in New York Wednesday about the situation in Gaza. Jocelyn Sambira reports.
Israel and the Palestinians should return to the negotiating table in Cairo to quickly agree on a lasting truce. The United Kingdom's ambassador to the UN and president of the Security Council, Mark Lyle Grant, made the appeal late on Wednesday. An Egyptian-brokered humanitarian ceasefire was breached before its expiration after rockets were fired from Gaza. Ambassador Grant said the members expressed grave concern at the return to hostilities and the loss of civilian lives and casualties.
The talks appear to be breaking down, and there has been a resumption of hostilities, and it was important for the Security Council to respond quickly to that, hence the agreed press elements. There is a second stage, of course, that we have been discussing with a number of different member states of the Security Council, which is around a Security Council resolution on a more sustainable ceasefire.
Ambassador Grant confirmed the Council had received a draft resolution introduced by Jordan on the Gaza crisis. Jocelyn Sambira, United Nations.
The Palestinian permanent representative to the UN, Dr. Riyad Mansour, spoke to the press after the meeting's conclusion.
We took note of the position declared by the members of the Security Council with regard to this continuous aggression by Israel against our people in the Gaza Strip. And, of course, from our side, we are still ready, our delegation, to engage under the auspices of the Egyptians in Cairo and through them with the Israeli side. It was the Israeli delegation that walked away from the negotiation. And it was also that the Israeli delegation that was putting unreasonable conditions Our delegation have shown tremendous amount of flexibility in terms of trying to find an agreement for a long-lasting ceasefire to stop the aggression against our people in Gaza, to lift the blockade, to open all the crossings, to allow our fishermen to fish deep in the sea, up to 12 miles and maybe longer, and to begin the reconstruction of the Gaza Strip. We are still willing and ready to resume the efforts in Cairo, and it is the Israeli side that has taken this option and continued with this massive attacks against our people in the Gaza Strip. In this connection, let me also add that Israel has never abided by the ceasefire. Israel continued to fly military planes over Gaza. They have continued to shoot at the civilian population from land and sea. They fired at people simply trying to make a living by fishing in the sea. They fired at children. As you know, yesterday and today, since breaking the ceasefire, a large number of civilians have been killed. 8 members of one family were completely killed. Israel has not stopped hostilities. Gaza has been pounded for over 4 weeks. Over 2,000 Palestinians have lost their lives. Over 70% were civilians, and more than 450 of them were children. We want a sustainable negotiated peace. We want to stop dying. We want the violence to end. In order to do that, Israel must cease its aggression and agree to a deal. Israelis need to agree to a deal in Cairo that ends the violence and the aggression and brings security and trust and to lift the siege against our people so that they can begin the process of normalizing their life. This means they must lift the siege again so that the underlying causes of the conflict can be remedied. The UN Security Council has a role in this connection and should uphold its duties. A draft resolution has been before the Security Council for weeks, and the Security Council should have adopted that draft resolution some time ago. And there is nothing before the Security Council except the draft resolution introduced by our Egyptian brothers, the representative of the Arab group in the Security Council, Jordan. And this draft resolution is supported by the Arab group, by the OIC, and by the non-aligned movement and many other countries. If other countries have ideas, especially those who have not engaged in serious discussions with the Jordanians or with us or with our friends in the Security Council, this is the opportunity for them to engage on the basis of the Arab draft resolution in blue. And if there are ideas that to be considered without fundamentally changing the essence of that draft resolution, I am sure that we will look at it with an open mind and open heart. But there is no other draft except this draft. And when people are ready to negotiate seriously, they have to negotiate on the basis of that draft. Thank you.
More than 40 Palestinians had been killed in the Gaza Strip during the first 2 days after the ceasefire ended, bringing the death toll from Israel's war against the Palestinian enclave to 2,065. The outgoing head of the UN's Human Rights Council, Navi Pillay, made what was likely her final report to the Security Council Thursday.
Complex and potentially highly eruptive conflicts are underway in Afghanistan, Central African Republic, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Iraq, Libya, Mali, the occupied Palestinian territory, Somalia, South Sudan, Sudan, and Ukraine. These crises hammer home the full cost of the international community's failure to prevent conflict. They combine massive bloodshed and devastation of infrastructure with acutely destabilizing transnational phenomena, including terrorism, the proliferation of prohibited weaponry, organized crime, and spoliation of natural resources. None of these crises erupted without warning. They built up over years and sometimes decades of human rights grievances, deficient or corrupt governance and judicial institutions, discrimination and exclusion, inequities in development, exploitation and denial of economic and social rights, and repression of civil society and public freedoms. Early detection systems such as the 51 special procedures experts of the Human Rights Council and systematic scrutiny by treaty bodies repeatedly alerted us to these shortfalls. So, although the specifics of each crisis could not necessarily be predicted, many of the human rights violations that were at their core were known. They could have been addressed.
She made the remarks the day after she issued a statement urging Washington to investigate allegations of police brutality and examine the root causes of racial discrimination in America. She added that racism and racial discrimination breed conflict and violence, and that, in her opinion, as a South African, there are many parts of the United States where apartheid is flourishing. Pillay ends her term as High Commissioner for Human Rights on September 1st. She'll be succeeded by Jordan's Prince Zayed Raad Zayed Hussein.
Before we go to any questions, let me just add a few words about the situation in Ferguson. Yesterday, as you know, I visited Ferguson in order to be debriefed on the ongoing federal civil rights investigation into the August 9th shooting death of Michael Brown, an investigation that I launched more than a week ago. During the course of my visit, I met with law enforcement as well as community leaders. We had, I think, constructive discussions about the importance of maintaining peace, averting future acts of violence or vandalism, and ensuring public safety, as well as the need for outreach and engagement to rebuild a fractured trust between the community and the law enforcement community that it serves. Going forward, I will continue to get regular updates and to closely monitor the situation as it unfolds. Now, although our investigation will take time, and although I cannot discuss the specifics of this case in greater detail since it remains open and very active, the people of Ferguson can have confidence in the federal agents, investigators, and prosecutors who are leading this process. Our investigation will be fair. It will be thorough, and it will be independent.
That was the U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder Thursday morning after returning from a visit to the city of Ferguson, Missouri. On Wednesday, he made these comments at a press conference in St. Louis.
Now, our investigation is different from that which the state is doing. We are looking for violations of federal criminal civil rights statutes, which is different from what the local investigation is. But we have brought a substantial number of people here, number of agents here, who've done a great job in the canvassing that they did over the past weekend. They continue to follow leads so that we can do a thorough and a fair job of making a determination about what happened on August the 9th. And I'm confident that through the ability of these people, we will be able to make a determination about whether or not any federal statutes have in fact been violated. My hope also is that through the trip that I'm making out here today, and by stressing the importance of and the way in which this investigation is going, that hopefully will have a calming influence on the area. If people know that a federal, thorough investigation is being done, being manned by these very capable people, my hope is that that will have give people some degree of confidence that the appropriate things are being done.
Journalist Caleb Maupin has been on the ground in Ferguson during the protests. We spoke with him Thursday about the events he witnessed Wednesday evening.
Last night there was some demonstration, but it was very rainy last night. And it was very small. It was only a couple hundred people. It was kind of uneventful. There was a huge police presence. They were making everyone keep moving and telling people they couldn't stand. One of the events that I witnessed that was worth noting was there was a young man who was there last night who had been hit with a rubber bullet in the face. Police denied that they had used rubber bullets. And now, with the video that has surfaced, it is confirmed that they did use rubber bullets. The shell casings have been discovered, and they did use rubber bullets on the previous night. And there was a young man who had been hit in the face with a rubber bullet, and he was attempting to give an interview to the media, talk about how he'd been hit in the face with a rubber bullet. And the police kept trying to stop the interview and kept telling everyone to move on. And it was kind of a tense situation, and they were like, making everyone walk as he was being interviewed, and that was one event that took place that was of interest last night.
The way the media is portraying it today is that their belief or their hope is that last night's calm is an indication of the temperament of the community calming down generally. Do you think that's it, or do you think it's more related to the weather?
I think the weather had something to do with it. I think, the fact that Eric Holder's in town, I think there are a couple factors involved, and we'll just have to see what comes next. I know today that there are big organizing meetings that have been called by various organizations that are calling for a step forward. I know somebody from the Oprah show is coming here, and there's supposed to be some meeting with people from the community and so on from the Oprah show this afternoon. But then in the evening, there's been a call for a mass meeting, at the site where the protests have been happening at night. There's been a call for there to be some kind of organizing meeting at night where people come and debate the next step forward. And at night at the site of where the protests have been, where the police don't want people to gather. So we'll have to see what happens. We'll have to see what the next step is. Eric Holder was in town yesterday. He took people to lunch and, spoke to people. So.
Meanwhile, a video recording has emerged that appears to contradict the police version of a killing involving St. Louis Metropolitan Police officers and yet another young black man near Ferguson this past Tuesday. We have this report from Press TV.
A new video has been released online, apparently contradicting the U.S. police account of the events which led to the killing of a second African-American man in Missouri. 23-year-old Kajime Powell was gunned down by two St. Louis police officers on Tuesday, exactly 10 days after the killing of a black teenager, Michael Brown, in the suburb of Ferguson. Local police officers claimed that they found an aggressive man armed with a knife and that they fired their weapons in fear of their lives. But the new footage, which has captured the moment when the cops shot at Powell, seems to contradict the official version, as the victim appears to be unarmed and not aggressive. According to reports, Powell was shot 9 times.
Oh my God. They just killed them, y'all.
Lawrence Hamm is the chair of the Newark-based People's Organization for Progress and was a resident of Newark during the 1967 Newark Rebellion. This past weekend, he spoke at the annual conference of the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations about the uprising in Ferguson, the 1960s Newark and Detroit rebellions, and current conditions in Newark 47 years after that city's uprising.
You know, in Ferguson, Missouri, they quelled the struggle, at least temporarily. They shut down the local police department and put a black state trooper over the police in Ferguson. And for a moment, people calmed down. You see how I made that immediate effect? But then what did they do? Folks are so stupid, right? Maybe they just was upset because the black man seemed to calm things down. They turn around and impose a curfew on people, try to impose a state of emergency and a police state instead of using their efforts to try to get justice for Michael Brown. So the people rose up again, and they should continue to rise up until they get justice for Michael Brown. Let Ferguson be a signal.
That's it.
To black people and people who want justice all over this country. for Progress has been struggling around the issue of police brutality. In Newark, New Jersey, the Justice Department announced that it had done a 3-year study. They said that 75% of the stop and frisk in Newark, New Jersey were unconstitutional. And that although black people make up 54% of Newark's population, they were 85% of the stop and frisk. Yeah. What did the Justice Department say? It said that the Newark Police Department had engaged in the use of excessive force and had abused people's constitutional rights. And on top of it, what did the Justice Department say? It said that the gang unit and the drug unit of the Newark Police Department stole the drugs and the cash of the same people they were arresting in the streets. And what did the Justice Department recommend? That the Newark Police Department be put under a federal monitor. A federal monitor. And more than that, they even recommended something that we've been calling for, and that is civilian oversight. We say more specifically, we want a police review board in Newark, New Jersey with subpoena powers, investigatory powers, and the power to punish police that abuse our people and abuse our constitutional rights. In New York City, they're demanding that Bratton step down in the aftermath of Eric Garner, and they're demanding a new police commission. Ferguson is two-thirds black. Two-thirds. They got 56 police in the department. Only 3 are black. So they put a black man, a state trooper, he ain't even in the local police, they put him in charge. So people are making demands, and we support all the demands for change that people are making. But brothers and sisters, we must understand this, that police brutality is not caused by a few aberrant rogue cops. It is a systemic problem. It arises out of the system of social and economic and political oppression that we live under. Why is it that police brutality persists? New York has a police review board, and they still have police brutality. There are 13 cities in the country that have police review. Why does it persist? It persists because the use of violence against black people has been necessary and condoned since the creation of the United States of America. We cannot have a system of slavery in place without the most extreme force. You cannot steal land and take the land of the indigenous people without the use of extreme force. The use of force against people of color, black people, and the indigenous has been codified in law. It was part of the law. And although it may not be the law anymore, it is so deep in the psychosocial fabric of the United States of America. They don't need a law. They know if they hire these police that they are going to abuse, and brutalize black people. And the police brutality will continue. It will continue after we get a police review board in Newark, even though we're fighting for the police review board. Because the police are part and parcel of a system of racial control that has existed in this country since African people were first brought here.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.